Hi, I'm John Rawling, welcoming you to Ringside Rewind, where I'm joined by Tris Dixon and Ian Dark. And we're grateful for sponsorship from Fleet UK, a car and commercial vehicle leasing company based in Hampshire, supporting our programme. Great people who've supplied customers for 20 years or more, including me. Wherever you are, they'll find and supply any car you want and work out financing options to best suit your needs. Fleet UK pride themselves on transparency, trust and fairness in every deal. And you can take it from me, they are brilliant at what they do. Just have a look and check them out at fleetuk.com.
Hello, welcome back to Ringside Rewind with me, Tris Dixon, joined as always by John Rawling and Ian Dark. Gents, it's great to see you. We are going to talk, we actually were originally going to talk a few weeks ago about Tyson Fury's fight with Alexander Usyk. That fight is obviously being postponed, but now we have another heavyweight fight heading towards us very, very quickly, and it's Anthony Joshua against Francis Ngannou. It's a wild card of a heavyweight fight, really. John, when you hear the names Anthony Joshua and Francis Ngannou, a couple of years ago, it was a circus attraction. But what's your take on it now?
Well, a couple of years ago, I'd be saying Francis who, wouldn't I, like everybody else. It's only really got credibility because he's come out of the mixed martial arts world and fought Tyson Fury in a fight that nobody gave him an earthly chance of winning, seemingly including Tyson Fury. And he went out and gave a great account of himself. So because of that, this fight against Anthony Joshua is most definitely causing interest, and there were plenty of people who thought that Ngannou beat Tyson Fury, and they believe that on that premise, there's certainly a great chance of him having a very good night against Anthony Joshua.
Ian, how about yourself? I mean, how do you see this fight? Because there's still a corner of people, and I hear this sometimes, saying that it's still a bit of a carnival event. In that, well, it was only competitive against Fury because Fury didn't train, Fury didn't show up, Fury didn't take it seriously, Fury was doing this, Fury was doing that, and Ngannou capitalized. And this time, Joshua is going to set everything straight. What's your take?
Well, that's what we're going to find out here, how good Ngannou is. Was that just a freak? Was it because Fury was way below par, hadn't prepared properly, wasn't mentally right for the fight? Or is Ngannou a bit better than everybody thought? And not just this freak show operator coming out of the mixed martial arts world. Tell you one thing, it's a calamity, isn't it, for Joshua, if he loses to a guy in his second pro fight. So they're taking a risk there. And up until recently, I was of the view that Joshua was at the stage of his career where he could come a cropper almost against anybody, but it was an improved performance against Otto Wallin last time out. He got his jab going. He got his right hand going. He looked sharper and more confident, but he looked sharper and more confident, and I'd built this rider in against somebody who's decent, but probably not a big puncher. So that, I think, you've got to factor into considerations here.
Yeah, John, in terms of the fight and the magnitude of it and that kind of stuff, it's very strange now. But, you know, there are a lot of people that now are interested in Joshua Ngannou as a boxing match. You know, people, I'm not saying they're saying it's 50-50, but after what happened with Fury, it has changed everything, hasn't it?
Well, that performance of Tyson Fury's against Ngannou, which was frankly pretty awful, wasn't it? You know, it's changed the landscape at the top of world heavyweight boxing, and the claims that Anthony Joshua can get right back to the summit suddenly have a bit more credibility if he can come through this fight and look good in the process. But, you know, I mean, it's an interesting one because I don't think that anything we've seen post Usyk has really suggested that he's substantially a different fighter, Anthony Joshua. There's still the big question mark about his chin. And the one thing that Ngannou can do quite definitely, irrespective of his boxing ability, he can bang. He can hit hard with both hands And he is a very, very strong man. You know, everybody who's been in the ring with him, either competitively or sparring, speaks of his immense strength and his power, particularly in his left hand. And Joshua's got to be well aware with that. And, you know, as he's preparing for this, his coach has said to him, you've got to give this guy respect. You've got to prepare properly. And he'll need to have done, because if he goes in there and produces a flaky, gun-shy sort of performance, there's every possibility he could get knocked out.
Ian, over the years, have you wished that you were ringside covering this Anthony Joshua story from you know, is it one that you wish that you'd been on the ride for?
Not particularly, no. I think there's been a lot of hype around him. I tell you what, I admire him. I admire any fighter who can make the kind of money that he's made out of boxing, because what is he worth? I think I looked up that celebrityworth.com has him worth something like 80 million euros, I think it is. So
did you look up John Rawling while you were there?
No, that wasn't worth it. He wasn't in the top 200. So, by the way, neither were you and neither was I. So that's where we're on the podcast. That's why we're doing Ringside Rewind.
between the three of us.
Yeah. But, yeah, I mean, I admire him because, you know, if you can sell 80,000, 90,000 tickets at Wembley and make yourself the big box office star that he's become, you've got to admire that. And to be honest with you, he's got to the stage, even though he isn't probably the fighter he looked like he was going to be 3 or 4 years ago, he's at that stage now where you could put him in with the cleaners at whatever arena they put it on and he'd still sell the tickets.
Well, I think the thing is he's filled out stadiums without having a Fury fight or something like that. I know obviously there was the Klitschko fight in Wembley, but he was able to do the numbers against the likes of Joseph Parker and stuff as well. So what is it, John, about Anthony Joshua that has, you know, because there's some haters out there for Joshua, but obviously he's got to be hitting the mark with his persona, his personality, for these people to go out in their tens of thousands to want to watch him.
Well, it was originally, I think, a little bit of the Frank Bruno syndrome, wasn't he? He was the big, lovable success story from the 2012 Olympics. And I think the profile that he got on terrestrial television there, and incidentally, I think he was fairly fortunate to take that gold medal, but that's another story. I think building from there, they were able to do a very good job in putting his professional persona together, and he's been brilliantly matched and brilliantly steered through. But, you know, you talk about the haters. I think that some of that came on the back of what he said round about the Black Lives Matter demonstrations, which I don't think even he would say did him too many favours with the benefit of hindsight. And plus, I think there were a lot of people who found his behaviour after the second Usyk defeat mystifying at best and outrageous at worst in some people's eyes. The interviews in the ring were a little bit distasteful, a little bit graceless. And I think a fair few people maybe looked at that and saw a different side of Anthony Joshua, which they didn't like very much. And there'd be haters as a result of that, and haters as well as ever, because of old-fashioned jealousy for somebody who's done spectacularly well, probably not with the ability of some of the great heavyweights of years gone by.
John, you say he's been brilliantly steered, and you mentioned the second fight with Usyk. That wasn't being brilliantly steered. That was a crazy fight for them to take. You knew what was going to happen. He was never going to be good enough to beat Usyk with his skill set. Why they did that, I've no idea. So that was a crazy self-delusional decision. And they tried to say, oh, it was a better performance second time around. Well, it was, but he was still clearly beaten. I don't know why they went that route. Can you explain that one, Tris?
Well, I think, you know, Usyk had forced the pace and had become mandatory. So he was due his shot. And also, I think the thing was, Usyk had beaten Tony Bellew and he had a star power and a star name attached to him.
Why do it again? He's thrashed you.
I mean, you know, Joshua, yeah, I mean, it's a great question, but he was better in the rematch, and he did change trainers, didn't he? He left Rob McCracken and joined Robert Garcia. So he must have thought that he might have been able to do something differently, you'd imagine, to box, you know, to... I don't know. It seems, with hindsight, it was a gamble that didn't pay off, but I guess he thought that he had it within him. And maybe, obviously, it was kind of now or never, in the sense that if he didn't get a rematch, then all the belts would be fragmented and they'd go their own ways, and he'd never get the chance to get them all back in the same fight again. But I suppose it's one of those, really, with, like I said, hindsight is a very powerful thing. But Ian, you actually said there that you don't think Joshua necessarily followed through on the potential that he'd shown, or that people had him, you know, the path that he was anointed with. John, what is your take on that? Do you think, you know, the big win over Klitschko was the seminal moment, you know, the Hat and Zoo of his career, and it's been not the same since?
Well, that was his big night, wasn't it? It, albeit against a pretty old Klitschko and having to get off the floor to do it. But that, with hindsight again, was probably his great night. It also underlined the fragility that we kind of knew that was there. And I think a younger Klitschko, it's not just me saying this, I think a lot of experts say, you know, by common consent, that a younger Klitschko would have jumped all over him after that knockdown, instead of standing back and allowing him effectively time to recover. But that was, that was a great performance from Joshua, but it also showed his fragility, which was ultimately underlined by the performance against Andy Ruiz Jr. in 2019. But we'd seen him as well against Alexander Povetkin have all sorts of trouble in the first two or three rounds. And yeah, he's when I say he's been well groomed and well handled, Ian, I think, you know, he was steered through, got the title, got through Klitschko, and then continued to get enormous paydays on the back of that. And I think initially they honestly thought that a small heavyweight, or a relatively small heavyweight like Usyk, didn't physically have the power to get in with him and to match him. Of course, that was shown to be catastrophically wrong. But, you know, when he's made the money that he's made and been world champion as he has been, and he's still very much in the mix at the age of 34, I don't think he's been handled too badly.
Well, yeah, I'd agree with that, John. Obviously, he's made a lot of money, but I was just pointing out one wrong turning in his career, and I think that was a big wrong turning. And you said hindsight's a wonderful thing, Tris. To be honest with you, I, and not only me, I said that the moment they signed for the fight, that's a crazy decision. He's going to get beaten again. And it has damaged his marketability and reputation and legacy, I think, to some extent as well. But I think he has problems with fighters who are skillsters, if you like. And I think that's why he'd have problems with Fury, big problems. I think he'd be bamboozled and outboxed by Fury. I think he'd just know too much for him, unless age has caught up with Fury in the interim. That's the only rider I would build into it.
Age, well, suppose, and those three savage fights against Deontay Wilder, I don't think he's been the same since then.
Yeah, I think, you know, where Ian talks about, you know, skillful fighters, John, we wouldn't necessarily have Ngannou at the top of that list. However, against Fury, he not only went southpaw for some of the fight, he actually had success with southpaw, and as a southpaw. And you think Fury sometimes goes southpaw to bamboozle his opponents. When Ngannou went southpaw, Fury tried to flip southpaw as well, as if to say, oh, I could do this too. And actually, Ngannou was just as effective left-handed or right-handed as he was left-handed. And I think that really, really stumped Fury. And we know that Joshua doesn't like a southpaw. You know, Usyk showed us that.
Yeah, and obviously Ngannou's boxing ability was underestimated big time. He's been showed himself to be considerably better than anybody had anticipated. We certainly couldn't glean it from the little videos that we'd seen in training, could we, when he was working with Mike Tyson. You know, what he produced actually in the ring against Tyson Fury was very different to what we'd seen before. But I think there, you know, there are two ways of looking at that, at that Fury performance. One is that he is very much, or what showed himself to be very much, a fighter on the slide. And Ngannou exposed that. And while you say he's got great boxing ability and he might stand Anthony Joshua on his head, I don't absolutely think that's a given, because I think an inspired Joshua, if he gets through this, is going to be somebody who's very much in the mix to be top of the pile again.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose that's an interesting point, Ian, is what if Joshua wins? What if Joshua loses?
Well, if he loses, goodbye. He goes a long way down the snake, doesn't he? If it's a game of snakes and ladders, which Mickey Duff always used to say, if you hit a snake, you go a long way down. He goes a long way down if he loses, I think, to Ngannou. Ngannou goes up a huge ladder and becomes a big part of the mix already. So that's what makes the fight interesting. There's a bit of jeopardy in there. I'm interested to know, what is Joshua's mindset these days? I think, Tris, you also saw as well this program he did with Louis Theroux. He obviously wanted to do this thing with Louis Theroux, and he was kind of laying his soul on the line, bearing his soul a little bit. And he's obviously, I think, hurt by the criticism that he's gun shy. And I think he's now got something to rail against. I think he did get complacent for a little while. I think he's got something to rail against and to say to the critics, I'm going to go out there and I'm going to prove you wrong. I think to some extent he's tried to reinvent himself and be more of a boxer. And you know, we saw that in the rematch with Ruiz, a safety first, box his way to victory. And I would think the people behind him are probably trying to steer him clear of punches as well now, after what happened against Ruiz and the other times he's been on the floor. So I think it's very interesting. Tris, what do you think his mindset is going into this?
It's interesting, isn't it? I wonder if, you know, the fact that the snowball of, and I use this word liberally because I don't necessarily mean this strictly, but I wonder if the snowball of hype coming to the end or being so dramatically ended after the second Usyk fight hasn't taken some of the pressure off and some of the burden of expectation that was on him before, because people do see him as maybe the third or fourth best heavyweight in the world, behind Usyk, behind Fury. So I wonder if that hasn't... Also, I was speaking to Joshua Buatsi about this recently, and he said no one is under pressure in boxing the same way that Anthony Joshua is. You know, if through the magnifying glass, there's no one, like, it's just not a relatable pressure. And maybe he has, you know, people try to find fault. People are sort of unkind in their criticisms. I did find the Louis Theroux thing really interesting, though, in the sense that, you know, I broke the story of Joshua turning pro in Boxing News after the Olympics. And, you know, we're about 11 years further on, and I don't really feel like I know him any better now than I did then. And it's interesting because, you know, when you talk about our careers, a lot of it, we've had really good access over the years. And I think Joshua is one of the first guys that has really been very, very hard to sit down and have a good interview with, a good long conversation, like the Louis Theroux thing. And I think it would have done him... It would have served him better, but the way that they've done things generally has been they've done one big media day when they announce a fight. Everyone goes and gets him. He's basically everyone's for an entire day, about 2 months before a fight. And then he retreats to his camp and you don't see him again until fight week. And then he's, you know, but he's done the media day. And so you need to, you've got your quotes from that thing 2 months earlier. And you don't really know him. And I, you know, I've asked for some sort of access before Saudi and there's nothing going for the press, unless you're possibly out there. So, you know, it's very difficult to sort of, you know, whether he's a nice guy or whatever, you can't really say it because you don't really know, because no one really gets to know the real AJ. And I think I do feel like that's one of the reasons why maybe he's criticized a little bit more, because people just don't know or understand him. I think people see that he's the face and of this, of all these brands, and he's this sort of blue chip boxer, and not saying he's a company man or anything like that, but they just, he's not relatable the same way he might have been many years ago. He's just, you know, like a Lewis Hamilton, like a Ronaldo. He's on a different stratosphere from the rest of us. We can't get access to him, and that's just the way it is.
He's a product, isn't he?
Well, I think that's the criticism. I think, and people don't really know. So yeah, it's tough. I don't think it's done him any favors. But like you guys both said, does he need any favors done? He's got all the money he wants in the world, is it just a matter of job done? You know, it doesn't matter what anyone really thinks. The job is to get him in, get him massive fights, make him loads of money, and get him out. And in that respect, job done.
Yeah, you don't warm to the man you don't really know, though, do you? I think you're absolutely spot on with that. I think that was one of the reasons. I know we harp on about him, and for obvious reasons, but, you know, sort of 40 years ago, whatever it was, 50 years ago, everybody felt as though they knew Muhammad Ali. And that's the difference between Ali and Joshua. You know, obviously they're streets apart in terms of ability, but just as people. And likewise, Frank Bruno, everybody felt as though they knew Frank. And Joshua is very much more this aloof and remote figure.
Because Marvin Hagler was like this as well. So fighters do vary. Some fighters like to mix. I remember, and I've told the story on here before, how Evander Holyfield had me for tea in his suite on the eve of the fight after he'd weighed in. So he was available 24/7 if you wanted an interview, just like Ali was, who would get up in the middle of the night to talk to the British press guys when they arrived at the camp. Others just want to hide themselves away. I remember talking to Marvin Hagler and asking him to do an interview 7 days before the fight for BBC Radio when he fought Tony Simpson in Worcester, Massachusetts. And he turned me down, and he turned down all the American writers as well, and just saying, I don't talk in the week of a championship fight. Sorry. So maybe there's something of that. I don't know. With Joshua, or is it, I suppose the worst case scenario is you'd look at it and say, well, has he become a little bit precious? Is his ego out of control? What do you think? You're around him more than me.
I think, I don't know, there's always people around them as well. Like, are you going to get a really good sit down interview without people being around him, you know, maybe telling him what questions to answer, what not to? I don't know. It's very, I've not been, you know, the last, what was covered, you know, the Jermaine Franklin build up, what came after that, some of the Hellenius build up. There wasn't any direct access. The thing is, I'm very aware here that you either sound bitter or you got an axe to grind. I'm not really fussed about the access, but the thing is, it's hard to get to know someone, and we want to know the fighters, don't we? We've always, you know, that's part of it. Like you said, they're all different, Ian, and it's not a criticism. I've said this countless times. It would be boring if everyone was the same. You know, if everyone was a beloved Henry Cooper, it would be a pretty dull job, because it's the same all the way through. You've got to have that variation of personalities. I just feel like the Joshua thing, it's an interesting thing, because you look at the fan base, and then there's this quiet movement against him online where people are very, very cynical and very, very tough on him. And it makes you think, well, tens of thousands of people want to go and see him and cheer him. But then you've got this quiet wave of anti Joshua sentiment online. And it's strange. I don't know. I'm not sure I've experienced it before, because when you look at a Nassim Hamed, they're divisive and people love to hate them. Joshua, it seems like there's two types of people, the fans and the haters. It seems to be quite a divisive figure, but I can't quite put my finger on why.
The fact he's divisive, though, he still sells the tickets, doesn't he? You
know, of course.
That was the Don King maxim. You know, you don't have to like me, but just know that I'm here. And it's the same with AJ, because I'm sure there are a significant number of people who will be buying the fight at whatever it is on the pay-per-view, 20 quid or whatever. And indeed, some of those who've actually spent the hard money and gone across to Riyadh. I think there'll be a substantial number who will want to see him beaten, but at the same time, they're still buying the fight. So, you know, you could argue that it doesn't really matter.
It's that kind of toxic thing that goes on in Britain, though, isn't it? part of this. If you're successful and you make a load of money and you become a big celebrity, and AJ has, he ticks all those boxes, people want to see you brought down. It's a twisted kind of horrible thing, but there's definitely an element of that in it. But maybe, as you said, Tris, the fact that he is that slightly distant figure, it rather raises the temperature on that anti-AJ feeling.
Yeah, it's interesting. I think, obviously, you know, what's interesting going into this fight as well is, and we touched upon this just before John joined the call, is you've got AJ, who is this decorated amateur. I know he had a short amateur career, but he went to the World Championships, boxed at the Olympics, has been a part of Team GB. And you've got Ngannou, who's come from a completely different world altogether. The pressure is on for AJ to deliver for boxing, isn't it, John?
Oh, yeah, certainly is. But likewise, there is a bit of pressure, I think, on Ngannou, because he produced that performance when so many thought that he had actually beaten Tyson Fury. And, you know, he's going into this with a degree of confidence, I think. I mean, I've been looking at the reports about him in the run-up to this. I've not seen him personally, but everybody says that he's approaching this with a real degree of confidence. And that's interesting. You know, he fancies it, I think, because he thinks that Joshua isn't too solid around the whiskers, and he thinks that he's the one who's going to show emphatically that with his power, and that he will get to him at some stage of the fight.
It's incredible, really, isn't it? On the basis of one fight under the Queensbury rules, we're thinking this highly about Ngannou. For me, as good a display as he put up against Fury, and as surprising a display as it was, I think, for most of us who thought the whole thing was a circus tent exercise, I think we need to see a bit more evidence, and that is what we're going to see here. I think if he comes out and he gives AJ the kind of problems he gave Fury, then you've got to tick the boxes and say, well, okay, hats off. This guy is the one who's breaking the mold, who can come straight into and swap sports, so to speak, and be a force within the new sport.
What about, John, what about if AJ just goes out and chins him?
I don't think he is going to. What makes you think that that's in any sense possible? I mean, Ngannou at no point looked as though he was going to get decked by one shot from Fury, did he? And I actually think that AJ's power is good, but I don't think it's devastating. And I can't see that happening. I think far more likely AJ is going to try and box his head off, and it's whether or not Ngannou can find a way to get past the boxing skills and put pressure on. It could well be that the sustained punishment from Joshua, and he finds a way to get a stoppage that way. But I don't see him going out and doing a Julian Jackson and just felling him with one big shot.
That is an interesting point. How big a puncher is Joshua? I think when you look at his record, you've probably got to say he's a very, very decent puncher indeed. It's a good stoppage number on his card, isn't there? Even if it was a 41-year-old Klitschko, even if Klitschko did let him off the hook, just like you said, John, because Joshua was fighting in a fog for a couple of rounds in that fight and Klitschko couldn't pull the trigger on him, not at that age. But he does have power, I think. He does have significant power.
Well, I think when he boxed Otto Wallin last time out, it was his first proper fight with Ben Davidson in the corner. And I know Ben Davidson said, look, to Joshua, like, you're a big lump, like, fight like a big lump. You know, what's all the boxing you've been doing with Hellenius, and certainly against Jermaine Franklin? Like, why are you trying to be something that you don't need to be? It's a little bit different when you're up against another lump, like Ngannou. So do you try and out-lump him, or does he go back to the boxing bit?
I love it.
I've never heard that one.
or do you go back to the boxing side of things and think, you know, we've got the advantage with the boxing and the movement and the footwork. You know, he is going to be like a tree, and we've just got to gradually, you know, start working on, start trying to gradually cut him down. I don't know, tactically. The thing is, he started very, very aggressively against Otto Wallin and put Wallin on the defensive right from the first bell, and it probably would serve his best interest to put a dent in Ngannou early, I would imagine.
Yeah, I'd buy that one. You mentioned Ben Davis. I think he is a very important figure because psychologically, I've got a lot of respect for how he understands a fighter. You know, you go back to the Tyson Fury story, and I don't think that Tyson could have done what he did without Ben Davison. And likewise, Ben is very clever, I think, at understanding the fragility, although he'd never use the word, I'm sure, of AJ. And he will work wonders in getting him to, in simple terms, believe in himself.
It's funny, actually. I was going to say this earlier. Ian, you said there about Louis Theroux and the documentary. You were saying he was a bit defensive when he was talking about his punch resilience and that kind of stuff. There's actually, DAZN of this week released a head-to-head between Fury and Ngannou. And Ngannou says, there's a point in there where Ngannou says something like, Fury is very resilient. He could get up from that shot. If I hit you with that shot, you're not getting up. And Joshua took exception to that and said, like, you know, yes, he was stopped by Andy Ruiz when he was sort of caught cold that night in New York. But other than that, he's like, show me when I've been knocked out, show me when I've been stopped. I wonder if we're not being a bit harsh on Joshua's ability to take a punch. Is it just something that you've always had a concern about, Ian?
Well, I have ever since the Andy Ruiz fight.
I suppose, is he insecure about it? Because maybe he realizes there's something to it.
Well, he comes in against a substitute opponent like Andy Ruiz as this roly-poly heavyweight who, to be honest with you, shouldn't really have been able to lay a glove on him. And remember in that fight, I think he'd already had Ruiz on the floor before all the accidents started to happen to him. Now, it may be for that fight that he wasn't properly switched on. Maybe in the way Fury wasn't switched on against Ngannou, I don't know. But whatever the reason, he got knocked around from pillar to post by a guy who was probably any price you wanted a name before going in. So I think there is that question mark about his chin still. And I'm wondering if he still has that in his mind, because he kind of seemed to change style a bit after that. And yeah, he did that with Wallin. And I think Wallin was ranked, you know, in the top five in the world by Box Rec and number 10 by The Ring, and had a half decent reputation as a kind of upper second division or lower first division heavyweight. So you've got to say good performance there. But you look at Wallin's record, it isn't a record that suggested that he was any kind of knockout specialist. So he was probably well chosen in that regard. I still think that little doubt is there for AJ, I do.
And I mean, if it's in the back of his mind, Triz, if he actually deep down has that worry, then, you know, I think we're going to see. I don't see him going in trying to match fire with fire and trying to outlump him, as you say. I think he's going to rely on.
There's probably a Ringside Rewind T-shirt out there to be made, isn't it? Get outlumped.
So it's good name for a book.
Ian, let me ask you this then, because you've been criticised as being the most cynical of the three of us online today. Not sure, but yes, someone said that you're actually quite grumpy.
All right. Oh, guilty, but I think, Lord, then. Okay.
I think they find it appealing. However, are you excited for this fight?
I wouldn't say excited.
You never disappoint, Ian. You never disappoint.
Well, I've not got an adrenaline rush, but am I interested to see it? Yes, I am. I wasn't really that interested to see Fury and Ngannou, but what happened in that fight, I think, has made us quite intrigued about what happens here because of the possibility that if Fury gets past Usyk, or we're going to see the two of them meet at long last. So, yeah, that narrative continues. It would be too late if it happens, but I think everybody wants it to happen. And like I've said on here before, I'm absolutely astonished that they never got that fight on 2 or 3 years ago, because you could have printed money for that. So that defied all boxing rules for me, that Fury never fought AJ 2 or 3 years ago, because everybody would have made a mint.
Somebody was talking about Tyson Fury in those two fights which are coming up against Usyk, the first one, and then presumably a rematch. There's talk of him getting $150 million out of those two fights, which is just staggering, staggering. Wow. Have you heard that, Triz?
No, I haven't. When you hear those sort of numbers, there's an element of you that just switches off. It's like seeing the lottery thing comes up on the app and says, oh, this week's a 20 million rollover. It just all rolls into one, doesn't it? It's just telephone numbers. It's bonkers. But it also doesn't surprise me. I mean, look at the Saudi influence. Look at what the footballers are getting over there. That's just where the money is, isn't it? That's where the money is. They've basically bought out the heavyweight division.
And Eddie Hearn is saying that the Saudis definitely want to put on Fury against AJ, should they both prevail in these two, well, semi-finals, I suppose you could call it that, couldn't you?
Which is great, because we want to see the fight. But I mean, I would rather see one of those fights in Wembley and the return in Old Trafford.
Mm. I don't think that's going to happen anymore, is it? Because the money's in Saudi Arabia. And it looks like, I've not been to one of the fights in Saudi Arabia, but it looks, and from everything I've heard, like a somewhat soulless experience.
Yeah, I've heard the same thing. And like you, I've not been out. John, you've not been out there yet, have you?
No. I mean, Frank Warren got very touchy about that when Simon Jordan spoke about that on TalkSport, and he sort of jumped down his throat a bit, as much as to say, so you're criticising a promotion because people aren't making a lot of noise. The important thing is the fight and what you're seeing. And I take that, but you know, for a fan's experience, I'm not convinced that going to Saudi Arabia is quite what your average boxing fan really wants. You know, you're wanting to have a big, fun time, booze included, yes, with your mates, and going watching a big boxing match, and that's not happening. You know, it ain't Las Vegas, is it?
You know, I mean, it's like going to see the World Cup final played in a library, isn't it?
Yeah.
Good analogy. So let me ask you this, John. Are you of the school of thought that at least they're happening? Or are you, you know, is it always constantly got an asterisk aside that says, well, it's good they're happening, but it's a shame that it is, you know, that they're not happening here in front of tens of thousands of fans who've supported these guys since they turned pro and followed the stories.
And people are conveniently sweeping under the carpet the whole sports washing issue, aren't they? I mean, Saudi Arabia is hardly a blameless country in the way in which people, and particularly minorities, be it women or gays or whatever, they're not exactly liberal with the way in which they approach them. And people seem to have stopped talking about that, as much as to say, well, there's so much money, so therefore it buys silence. But I agree with Ian, really. I think it's, if you've got that fantastic fight, Fury and Joshua, if that comes off, even if it's not for a world title, you know, let's suppose that both of them get beaten. There's still currency in that fight. And I think that putting it on in Saudi Arabia, okay, it might be the reality, just as it was the reality that Mike Tyson would fight in Las Vegas and other big names thereafter. But I think it is a shame that the ordinary fan doesn't have the chance to have a few pints with his mates, go to the fight and say, I was there.
I think your point's a good one, John. And that's, you know, and you've got to keep the fans always in mind. But I take your point as well, Tris, that the weight of money is making these fights happen. And for most people, it's a televisual experience, isn't it? Watching big fights, most people don't get to go to them anyway. So if they do get to see Tyson Fury against Anthony Joshua, and it's because of the weight of Saudi money, well, you'd have to say that's okay, really. But yeah, John's point's a good one. But, you know, the sports washing, that is another debate and another issue of Ringside Rewind and any other sports program you care to mention. That's a big side issue, isn't it?
Yeah, and it's not even a side issue, is it? You know, it's a cloud, isn't it? It's a cloud that hovers over all of the stuff. But I was thinking about this, you know, what is the benefit of being in a moral minority when you see the people going out there, when you see the sports stars, the managers, the trainers, the guys across the board, whether it's golf, tennis, football, music, everything, like they are actors. There was that picture of Turki Alalshikh with, you know, God, the whole world, Anthony Hopkins and about 30 other, you know, of the most famous people in the world. And you think, like, what's the point in even being part of this moral minority and saying, oh, you know, I'm not sure about that, when everyone just seems to be all in over there? It seems like we're being absolutely crushed by a tidal wave of sports washing.
Seems like we're being crushed by a tidal wave of money.
Well, we're not.
logical thought is being pushed totally to one side. You know, I mean, there's an element of logic being pushed aside by the heavyweights. I know of at least one major newspaper, once regarded as one of the bastions of sports reporting, who's told their supposed boxing correspondent, in inverted commas, that he's going to get nothing in the paper apart from heavyweights from now on. You know, what's when you're fighting that sort of logic in the makers and shakers of the media world, it's a struggle. And then to be somehow made to not say it as it is, considering what's going on and who's putting these fights on, where the money's coming from and how people are treated over there. Everybody's silence is being bought. You know, you don't toe the line and you don't go. I think that's a very, very worrying sort of state of affairs. There's been parallels in history. If you want to go back a century or more, there have been parallels there. And I think it's a very uncomfortable place to be.
I do wonder, you know, obviously you mentioned Muhammad Ali and we talked about his charisma a lot. And obviously he made that really important decision not to get caught up with Vietnam, and he wasn't drafted. We saw Rory McIlroy initially take a stand against competing over there for LIV Golf. We kind of know how that worked out, in the sense that LIV Golf hoovered up the PGA Tour in some way, shape or form. But what if one of these guys takes a stand? Are they going to be applauded, or is it just business as usual, just without that person?
Well, LIV Golf, just going back on that, nobody's watching LIV Golf. And John Rahm might have disappeared into thin air, frankly, having signed for goodness knows how many millions of dollars. Who knows what John Rahm is doing anymore, this great golfer, this brilliant golfer. He's gone into hiding. So although they've got all this money, and we don't know how it'll work out, that golf war, at the moment, no TV company is interested really in showing it, are they? Not any TV company that matters. So maybe there, you know, it isn't a tidal wave of a Saudi takeover. But, you know, we're digressing into another issue. But I do agree with everything John said. We should have scruples. There should be a stand against it.
John, what if one fighter just bucked the trend, you know, an AJ, and said, no, like, I'm not going to go out there for that?
I would personally think that that was wonderful. And I think there would be a lot of right-feeling people around the world who would applaud him for his stance. You know, it'd be interesting to go back in time and think what an educated man like Gene Tunney might have made of all this, to have actually seen Muhammad Ali, and what would he have made of all this? And it'd have been nice to think that somebody somewhere would have stood against it. And if somebody chooses to, personally, I'd very much applaud it, because I think there's a huge amount of money still to be made in boxing on the back of ability without having to take the money from the Middle East.
Yeah, but you can see it from the fighter's point of view that their career is a relatively short one. And if somebody says you're going to get $50 million to go and fight in Saudi, or you can have the same fight somewhere else for $12.5 million, what decision are they going to take? I mean, it's a bit like the story with Jordan Henderson, wasn't it? In the football, the Liverpool player going to Saudi Arabia, because, you know, he never said that, but we all knew it was for the money. It was money that you couldn't turn down. So I'm sympathetic to the sportsmen who make that decision, really, because they have to think of their family and their own situation first.
Yeah, and I guess to be honest, we've all had, at a very, very, very much reduced level, but we've all had financial offers wafted in front of us in our careers. And with the benefit of hindsight, was it the right thing to do to take them? But we did take them, and you move on and play your cards accordingly as a result of that.
So, John Rawling, I'm now offering you $3 million a year to go and be the PR man for the Saudi government entertainment industry. Are you taking the job?
No, I wouldn't. I would not take that. Absolutely not.
That's an unfair question.
Okay, right. That was really interesting. I know we've just digressed from our subject matter, but I mean, it's still highly relevant, and it's the surroundings of this fight. So, I mean, it is important. If it was in Las Vegas or Wembley, we'd have to be talking about it. But the fact is, it is in Saudi Arabia. So I'm pleased that we have talked about it. But going back to the actual fight, if you're Ngannou, John, how do you go about this fight, and what do you think Joshua is going to do? And do you jump on Joshua, try and start him early, or what? What would you do?
I think the only way Ngannou wins, really, is to prove that he is physically the superior man. He's got to find a way to negate the hand speed of Joshua. He's got to find a way to get in close and bully him around, show his sheer strength. We already know that he's got far better stamina than he was credited with. He lasted the distance well against Tyson Fury. So I don't think he's going to fade. But I think if he's going to win, he's got to get inside, he's got to get close, and he's got to land some big shots. It's the only way he's going to do it. He's not going to land more punches than Anthony Joshua. He's not going to have better footwork. He's not going to have better technical skills. So he's got to find a way to get past those long levers of Joshua, and he's got to find a way to bang him out.
Do you think he's got the technical ability to get there, to land the punches that he needs?
Well, I don't think he has. No, I don't think he has. I mean, if we're going down into the realms of predictions, I don't see it being a quick ending in this fight. But I think that Anthony Joshua will be way too good technically for him. And I think he'll box his head off. And I think he'll win by either fairly late stoppage or a very wide points margin.
Yeah, I'd agree with that. That's exactly how I would see that fight evolving. What about you, Tris?
Well, I do wonder, just to play devil's advocate and throw something else into the mix, you did say about actually how well Ngannou did the rounds against Fury. And there has been there's been a question mark about Joshua's gas tank, hasn't there, all the way through. And if Ngannou chooses to march forward behind a high guard and Joshua's not able to put a dent in him, and Ngannou's making him work and making him work and making him work and suffocating him with pressure, and whether he's getting him to work by movement or throwing punches to try and keep him off, there's a case to be made for Joshua running out of gas late on. It is only a 10-round fight. And it was funny in that face-off, and Ngannou said, "Look, I'm just a beginner. Why do you want me to do 12 rounds? He put his hand up. He said, "It's me. That's why it's 10 rounds. He's like, this is new. I'm not even a boxer." You can see... You know, I think that's the interesting thing is, does Joshua's power register on Ngannou, and does it stop him marching / plodding forwards and making Joshua work as much as or more than Joshua actually wants to? I do agree with your consensus, though, in the sense that I can see Joshua being just, you know, the fact that he's a much more schooled operator. And quick, fast hands. He can get his hands off and combinations off quickly and move off to safety. I think that could be the story of the fight. But after what happened last October in Saudi Arabia, nothing's going to surprise me. I think watching that knockdown when Ngannou knocked Fury down was one of the... top three things, and I was watching from my sofa, but one of the top three things I've seen in sport in terms of being unexpected. You know, what the hell? What the hell was that? You know, when the world heavyweight champion, who everyone was saying, you know, was a generational talent, was knocked down and hurt and shaken by this guy who had never had a professional fight before. It definitely opens your eyes to the possibility of what if, doesn't it? You know, you can't help that now.
But forewarned is forearmed. There's an element, a little bit of that, isn't there now, in that, because there's no question at all that AJ is going to go into this fight taking it easy, either mentally or physically. You'd expect him to be in tip-top shape, and that's the word coming out of the camp. But, you know, hey, been around fighters a long time, and they all say they're in the shape of their life, don't they, for every single fight. And in some cases, they've been very far from in the shape of their life.
Well, I had this conversation with Andy Lee yesterday, actually, and he said it was, you know, the Fury fight was good for both Ngannou and for Joshua. Joshua got to see what's in front of him. That Fury, it was a blind spot for Fury, wasn't it? He didn't know what was coming. So Joshua has that advantage. Problem is now, Ngannou's got the advantage of going 10 rounds with Fury in the bank, and how to pace himself, how to work, and all the rest of it. Like, that's an invaluable experience, and another camp behind him. So there's pros for both in this. And I'm not trying to sell it as a big 50-50. Obviously, that's not the job here and all the rest of it. But, you know, obviously, having seen what I've seen that we all saw last October, there's obviously always going to be something in the back of our mind now thinking, what if? Because it wasn't there last year. Going into that fight in October, we wouldn't have dared do a podcast on that fight because we all thought it was easy money.
So we all think AJ is going to win this fight. But we're all thinking there is just that possibility of there being upset, which, of course, is the ideal sell point if you're trying to flog the pay-per-view, isn't it?
Yeah.
So that's what a promoter wants. You want there to be an element of doubt, an element of mystery, and there is.
Yeah, and I mean, buy it now.
Yeah, yeah,
etc. I mean, and that's the thing. I mean, you know, Ngannou said that in that head-to-head. You know, if he doesn't think Joshua can get up from the same shot that he landed on Fury, you know, that's what we're buying to see, isn't it? And to see if, and we're also, you know, as a gauge, people are going to gauge what Joshua has got left in the tank. In what he told me a year or so ago was one last run. You know, if he does a great number on Ngannou, then that really makes the Fury fight very interesting, doesn't it? Fury, you know, John, you said at the start, you know, Fury may be showing signs of decline from the Wilder trilogy and getting up there in age a little bit. Joshua, who's lived a life all the way through, being, you know, always in the gym and always training, very unlike Fury, who obviously ballooned up to 30 stone and was doing all sorts. It makes you wonder, you know, if Joshua really makes a statement, I could see the bookmakers making Joshua the favourite going into a Fury fight.
Absolutely, so could I. I mean, I've followed the odds on the Fury-Usyk fights, and it started off with Fury a very, very warm favourite indeed to account for Usyk. But now it's more like a pick-em fight. I absolutely agree with you, particularly if he struggles against Usyk. And I think there's every possibility on the evidence of what we've actually seen, there's a very real possibility that Tyson Fury is going to find that a very, very hard night against Usyk. And on the basis of that, yeah, I'd agree with you. He could, particularly, I mean, if Usyk beats him and beats him well, then yeah, you're going to say Joshua's got a great chance.
I give Usyk a big chance against Fury. I would have done even against the peak Fury. I know Fury is the bigger man and all that, hence the odds heavily in his favour when the betting line started. But Usyk's skill set is really something to behold. He's a guy who finds the answers, and he won't be in any way psychologically worried at all about going in with Tyson Fury. So I think Usyk has got a very live chance in that particular fight, which comes up, I think, in May, doesn't it? Now, that's the delayed fight. Going back to this one, I think Joshua really needs to put on an electric display, to follow up what he did against Wallin, to make us believe again. But I think he might have looked, and his camp might have looked, at Ngannou putting Fury on the floor, and we might see a quite cautious AJ.
Yeah, I think, by the way, who knew that Francis Ngannou Usyk was the fight we all wanted? But, you know, God knows where we're going to be 6 months from now. You know, this was the conversation I was having with Andy Lee yesterday, you know, because he's got Joseph Parker against Zile Zhang on the undercard. And if Parker wins, Zhang's got a rematch clause, but then Fury and Usyk have got to fight twice as well. And that leaves Joshua, you know, looking for another dance partner if he gets through Ngannou. So there's so many moving parts. Obviously, all the parts are in Saudi Arabia, but it's a fascinating landscape, the heavyweight division. And, you know, maybe a couple of years too late from where we wanted him to be, you know, when Wilder was more of a threat than we think he might be now, with Fury and Joshua, you know, before they have so many question marks about what they've got left. And then obviously Usyk, you know, who's sort of really come through the ranks to, I think, be certainly, I think he's for many a sentimental number one after what's happened with Ukraine and everything else. It's an interesting mix. I mean, I don't know. Let's finish on this because I know people like our nostalgic takes. This era of the heavyweights, how do we compare with, let's say, the early 90s with Bo, Holyfield, Tyson, Lennox coming through, and then that plethora of talent underneath, you know, Buster Douglas, Oliver McCall, you know, George Foreman still lurking, Michael Moore. Is this anything like that at all, or are we just looking at a very small group at the top and the rest of the world?
Do you want me to go?
Yeah, go for it, John.
Well, I think that they have marketed it and hyped up the interest wonderfully, but I don't think that as a talent base and as a fight era, I don't think this is in any sense of the word anything like a heavyweight golden era, and it doesn't compare for me.
Yeah, I tend to agree. I mean, it may be generational, this, because this is the new wave. And if you asked a panel of people who are under the age of 30, they would definitely say this is their golden era. So I don't think we should be too dismissive about it. There have been, you know, wonderful heavyweight eras with Ali and Frazier and Foreman, etc., in the 60s and 70s, and the one you referred to, Tris, with Bowen, Holyfield and Lennox, etc. But, you know, for this generation, they're wrapped up in the story of these heavyweights. I think they're a bit fed up with not seeing them fight each other. Mm-hmm. So let's hope they all do.
So I think that's the thing, Ian. And I think that's exactly the thing. I think we would be more fondly talking about these guys had they all been on their second go round of fighting each other, rather than us, you know, now these guys looking towards their mid to late 30s. And, you know, Wilder's fought Fury, Fury's fought Wilder. AJ's not fought either of them, but he's fought Usyk. Usyk's not fought Fury yet, you know, might not fight Wilder. If they'd all fought each other now, we might have infinitely more respect and more affection for them. But the fact is they've been dancing around one another, taking mandatories, taking tune-ups and all the rest of it, waiting for the big money to be delivered. And it's not happened, has it? And I think that's been the most frustrating thing. Had we had a sort of four kings where we'd had 6 to 8 fights out of them against each other, then maybe we'd be saying, look, these are all great guys because they've all fought the best and they all fought each other. But the fact of the matter is they've not.
And that is absolutely spot on. And it's probably about where we leave it, isn't it?
Yes, I think so, gents. I think so. It's been good. This first time we've done sort of one of these breakdowns of a major fight. I think we should definitely reconvene after the fight to realize and share with everyone how wrong we've been about everything. But no, it's been good. It's been good. I mean, I'm looking forward to it. I am. And it's weird to say that. And I can hear myself saying it and think and shake my head at the same time. But after what happened last time, I'm in no position to disagree because I was proved emphatically wrong with Fury and Ngannou. So maybe I'll be proved wrong again. Because the problem was with that fight, by the way, Fury had the whole opportunity to put these crossover fights to bed. If he had done a number on Ngannou, there's a big part of me that thinks they would have just gone away. But he opened Pandora's box by making it so close and being dropped and making it interesting. And then obviously, you know, everyone started talking about crossover fights again. Joshua, now it might be over to AJ to set things straight, maybe, and for the pro boxing fans to just put a lid on these crossover fights.
Get Jake Paul in there.
Yeah. John Rawling against Ian Dark could be back on.
Just not in Saudi.
Yeah. No, just not in Saudi, no.
Oh, dear. Gents, this has been a lot of fun. I've really enjoyed it. And guys, thank you so much for tuning in to Ringside Rewind, and we'll be back soon.
Hi, I'm John Rawling, welcoming you to Ringside Rewind, where I'm joined by Tris Dixon and Ian Dark. And we're grateful for sponsorship from Fleet UK, a car and commercial vehicle leasing company based in Hampshire, supporting our programme. Great people who've supplied customers for 20 years or more, including me. Wherever you are, they'll find and supply any car you want and work out financing options to best suit your needs. Fleet UK pride themselves on transparency, trust and fairness in every deal. And you can take it from me, they are brilliant at what they do. Just have a look and check them out at fleetuk.com.